HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 177, recorded live Thursday, August 27th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Richard Campbell.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And, you know, I talked to Richard Campbell last week, and it was just too much darn fun, and we kept talking after we recorded. So who knows? Maybe it's a regular thing, maybe it's not. You know, I'll talk to Richard as long as he'll talk to me. So it's back. He's back. It's Richard.
You started. Hi, Richard. You started it. That's not me.
I know.
Where were we? I think it was like in Wisconsin where we ended up doing that whole discussion about our horror stories of dealing with scaling websites.
Oh, yeah. That's when this started.
That's when this started.
You're absolutely right. We were sitting in, it wasn't Wisconsin.
I think
we were sitting in the corner of a conference, though, somewhere, and said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's start recording. Was it Wisconsin? Ohio?
Yeah, it was
somewhere in the Midwest.
Somewhere in the Midwest, yeah.
So I tried to call you a minute ago, and
you succeeded in calling me.
Well, I did call you. We're talking now, but I couldn't find your cell, so I dialed what I thought was your cell.
You did, and my cell automatically when I'm in my office because I shut my cell off because it interferes with the audio stuff. It automatically forwards to the office number.
Okay, so then the office phone says, "Hi, you've reached the Campbell residence. Please say the name of who you want to talk to." I'm like, well, who did I call? What did I do? Did I call a house? Is this his family? You know, so I just said, Richard. And then it said, calling Richard Campbell. And then I got you.
Right.
That's hardcore. That's your freaking house.
Yeah. Well, for starters, no phone actually rang until you said Richard and it went to my phone. So
no,
yeah, no.
Okay, well, where what rang? I mean, something was
my
wrong.
Phone.
Someone.
The point is that when you just call me until you say my name, no phone rang anywhere in the house. The nice thing is that is when you're staying at my place, for example, Scott, you can have your kids call the house and just say guest, and it'll go ring only in the guest room.
Wow.
So just and it totally does in the telemarketer because they don't know who they're calling.
Right, because you didn't. This was what was interesting. I waited for the list.
That's right. There is no
list. I never
got
a list.
I turned the list off for exactly that reason.
Okay. Now, is this Google Voice or what is happening here?
This product is made by Microsoft and it's called...
No.
It's called Response Point.
Response Point.
Yes.
I'm going to Google that with Bing right now.
Yeah. Well, and if you can go to Microsoft.com/ResponsePoint, there's a whole site there.
Okay.
It came out a couple of years ago. There's three different hardware manufacturers making stuff for it. It's a company called Syspine.
Yeah. Small business phone system.
That's right.
Buy online.
So I picked up a Syspine system, which was the base unit with four phone lines going into it and six handsets for about $1,200.
Okay. Oh, they have it at Costco.
Here you go.
All right. This is insane. I've never heard of this. Oh, wow. Look at that. VoIP Fist system with four phones. There's like a box powered by Microsoft Response Point. And there's a whole thing. Mac, eight different analog phone lines, 50 extensions.
But plus, it also supports all the SIP lines. So if you want to bring in, you know, VoIP lines, that's fine. It works with that just fine. But also stuff like you can set up an auto. Well, I've got it configured with auto attendant, or you can have it go to a particular phone line. Uh-huh. In the auto attendant mode, you can ask questions like, what is your fax number? What are your hours? And so forth. And you can pre-record responses to all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very clever for an inexpensive phone system.
Wow. There's a Syspine six-pack.
Yeah. The reason I put it into the house was I got teenage daughters, so I don't want to take their messages. I want to just forward to their phone. Right. So
don't want to hear the phone ring.
Don't want to hear the phone ring unless it's for me. There's a blue button on all these phones. When you push that, say we're on a call, and you know I pick up the call and it's for one of my daughters. I push the blue button, say transfer to daughter, and it takes the call over there.
Wow.
Intercom system through the whole house, so you can hit a button and say intercom to the phone you want to go to, and it just sends you there.
That's insane.
It's amazing little product. They're just stunned by it, and nobody seems to know about it.
Who does your phone system? I mean, how does that work? There's the thing, there's the box, and all the software. But
right.
What do you use Vonage, or who's doing the phony part?
So I have analog lines from the local telco.
Hang on. Who's that? I think one of my sons has picked up the phone.
Yep.
Yeah, hang on a second. Hey, Mo? Hang on one second. I'm going to put the phone down. This will be an edit point.
No problem.
That's bizarre.
Hi.
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 Hi. Can you hand the phone to Mommy, please? Give the phone to Mommy, please.
Hi.
Hey, Mo? Get the son off the phone. I'm using the phone.
Wow.
Get the phone. Can you tell Mommy to keep Mimsy off the phone, please? You there?
That was awesome. We got to leave that in.
Are you going to leave that in?
Hi.
Oh, my gosh.
So, speaking of phone systems, mm-hmm. would it have prevented that?
Yes, actually, because it's a PBX, so there's no way to pick up a line.
PBX.
Yeah, it's like I had a dial 9 for an outside line. The whole concept of being able to pick up an existing phone line is foreign, right? You actually have to call.
Oh, it's like an internal. So PBX is an internal phone system.
Yeah, right.
It's a phone system that doesn't leave the house unless you let it leave the house.
Yeah, private exchange, right? That's the whole idea. So if I want somebody else to be able to listen to this call, I would have to press the conference line and tell it what phone, the phone I wanted to pull into the call, and then we'd both be on, that kind of thing.
What's the difference between response point and Asterix or that open source PBX thing?
There's really not a lot of difference between them. They're more or less the same thing. The only thing with Asterix being open source is that you got to pick a vendor. There's lots of different products, or try and assemble it yourself. And I really looked hard at I was very close to buying an Asterix system before I found response point. Very, very close. Because I wanted those kinds of features. I wanted my voice to mail to go directly to email. I wanted all that intercom stuff. I wanted all those things. And Asterix offered the whole thing, but you largely have to build it yourself. And this was in a box, set it up, had it up running in an hour. It's got a Windows interface. I dial the phone now by literally selecting from a list of my numbers from Outlook and saying, dial that number, and off it goes.
Wow. Well, this isn't the topic that I thought we were going to talk about at all.
No, it only happened because you phoned me, right?
I'm never going to phone you again. You've scared me away from your crazy phone. Madness. So that's pretty cool. Well, gosh, I don't know if my 18-month-old baby requires a PBX at the house here, but I know where to get one now.
Oh,
at Costco.
Apparently.
Yeah, that's pretty slick. Cool. So, gosh. You've thrown me for a loop.
I've totally.
Hey, I've got a buddy of mine loaned me his Kindle DX. I've got a Kindle.
That's the big one, right?
Oh yeah, it's massive.
Yeah,
it's huge, bigger than your head, and that's a big thing to say.
Dude, there's nothing bigger than my head.
I've got a Kindle myself, and I love it. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Cannot say enough nice things about it. And I apologize to people who live internationally.
Like me?
That you do not have the Kindle. Yeah, you'd have to hold it up and point it towards the U.S.
Yeah. Well, and I've seriously considered a Kindle DX because it does have the USB interface, so I should be able to load books and stuff that way, because I obviously am outside of Sprint's coverage from here.
Right, and you can also email stuff directly to the Kindle. So each Kindle has its own email address.
Which I think is very cool.
It's deeply cool. So if you have a PDF or a Word document or whatever, you can just forward it. And with the Kindle DX, it's got native PDF support.
But the only way for me to be able to email it is to be on that 3G network, because that's how it gets its mail.
No, right? Yeah, you're right. You're right. That's a good point.
If it had Wi-Fi, I just need Wi-Fi. But Sony just announced a new reader that's got Wi-Fi in it.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. The Sony reader, I don't know. I just, the Sony, I had the original Sony reader back in the day, and I ended up sending it back. It was just, it wasn't right. It wasn't set up to read. It was set up to be a cool Star Trek pad, but it was not. I did not find it that useful.
I too have one of the original readers, and I still have mine because I could make it work outside the U.S.
Yeah. Do you think wireless is really necessary?
You know what? I'm wrong. Sony does not have Wi-Fi in it, but there's another one planned called Plastic that has a Wi-Fi.
What's that called? Real Plastic? Plastic Logic?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Well, the new Sony's at Touch, so no wireless, but you can touch it.
Yeah. But it does have the 3G network, and they've got this deal with the libraries, right? Like the New York Library signed up, so you get this sort of DRM book for 3 weeks.
Right.
Which is an interesting, you're really starting to see a picture of where this is going to go. We're making these first stumbling steps, but you know, give it a little more time, and we're going to have this device. I really think this is going to be one device, this PDA type device that is my phone, that is my reader, is you know, all of those things in one.
Well, do you think that there an iPad is coming from Apple?
Absolutely.
And you think that it's going to be something that is a, is it going to be a big iPhone, or is it going to be a color touchy Kindle, or?
I think it's going to be a big iPhone.
Really? So you think it's just a big swollen iPhone?
Yeah. Well,
a big 6-7 inch iPhone.
Yeah, large screen type iPhone, thinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether it should be an iTouch or iPhone is a good question, but I think they've got the touch thing down. They figured out how to make the screen bigger, and they're trying to sort of cross that line into the tablet space. Mm-hmm. Apple never got over the Newton, you know?
No, I mean, I haven't got over the Newton. I'm looking at a Newton right now. It's sitting on my little IKEA shelves behind me here.
And I bet battery is fully discharged on it too, right?
No, actually, it's funny you mentioned that. The great thing about the Newton was that the AAA batteries would last for 2 weeks. So I just have to visit my Newton every, you know, twice a month and keep it going. And I've got some massive memory expansion on it. I've got the 4 megabyte card there.
Megabyte?
Megabyte card, which is nice. And the 2 megabyte expansion card. Because the Newton 2000 had 2 slots. That was such a great device.
It was so far ahead of its time.
Even the battery life, it was glorious. It would last for weeks and weeks and weeks. It sipped the battery. So you're saying that I get all the benefits of the iPhone and all the benefits of the iPhone's battery life. So do I have to have a tether to plug this thing into the mains?
No, as long as it's plugged into the wall, it'll be work just fine.
Yeah, that's going to be a giant remote control.
You're going to need the iBackpack, I think.
I've done that. Have you seen those pictures of me? Actually, I have a picture of me at PDC with a laptop tethered to an iPhone talking on it, because it's the only thing that would get the iPhone past the noon mark. That's like all technology on the planet right now is focused on getting iPhones to last beyond noon for their battery.
I've been looking at some of the military gear they've been playing with now that uses physical motion to charge batteries, and they've got one in the 150-watt range now that fits into a backpack. So as you walk with your backpack on, it would be charging batteries.
That's cool. You know, didn't they promise to do this with our shoes? I mean, I think it's kind of ironic that you can get the Nike shoe, iPod thing.
Yeah.
But they couldn't just throw a rattle in there to make some power while I'm running to my power song.
Yeah, they are still figuring that stuff out. That power is becoming the problem more and more and more. It is how do we package up power in a good package?
Right, and also in a way that isn't completely toxic to the environment. My son has this Thomas the Tank Engine ride-along train, like a little mini 3-year-old size train, and it uses this beast of a lead acid battery that, I mean, when I'm plugging, you know, it's like this disgusting, you know, ecological nightmare in a box that, you know, makes me feel like I'm changing the battery on like an old Dodge Charger.
Yeah.
And then I put the little plastic Thomas seat on it, and then suddenly, like, I've hidden it.
It's all fine.
It's just such a the whole Thomas train is really just a metaphor for everything that we're doing right now.
Everything that's wrong in this world.
Right. And I have to tell my son, you know, don't open the seat, you know, battery acid leaking out of Thomas. And just, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And of course, the runtime on the battery is like 12 minutes.
Right.
And then I was just over at Goodwill recently. You guys have Goodwill in Canada?
Yeah, we have a version of that, yes.
Okay. I was at Goodwill, which is the local, secondhand shop. And don't you love it when you find something that just shouldn't be at Goodwill? Like, what's the story here? How did this get here? Why did it come to me? I found a Dyson, you know, the Dyson vacuum cleaner?
Yeah.
The Dyson handheld vac. Brand new in the box. Got
at Goodwill.
Goodwill. Some corporation didn't want a freaking awesome vacuum cleaner.
Maybe.
Battery life on the vacuum is actually capped. It's got I don't know whether it's an expectations thing, but somehow Dyson put a timer on it. It'll run for 6 minutes.
Nice.
Which is funny because my wife says she can make it about 3/4 of the way up the stairs and then it stops. And then now she's mad at she's like, this is a useless device. It has a weak battery. And I think what the guy did, because, you know, Dyson is obsessed with sucking, with suction. He has, I think, I'm putting words in his mouth, that he's basically controlling expectations of power and suction by capping the amount of time.
Right.
So it'll never just fade away.
Yeah, no, it needs to be full power, and it shuts off the moment it's not full power.
Exactly. Yeah. And that would be interesting if laptops and phones did that. Just,
you know,
sorry, I can't give you an awesome experience, so no one will have it.
I don't hate lead-acid batteries like you do, because I know they're fully recyclable. The chemicals in them, the lead, everything can be regenerated into a new battery.
I have to go find the place.
Yeah, but at least you can recycle it. Many of these alkali batteries and stuff, they're much tougher to recycle.
Really?
Yeah. The technology for recycling lead acid, I know it's not a pretty battery, and if you put it in the garbage, you're committing a serious evil, but I'm telling you, virtually everything in a lead acid battery can be recycled.
All right, well, that's good. So I just need to find my local battery recycling place.
That's right.
Which really you need to be doing with all your batteries.
Batteries
need a separate place in your house.
I have a plastic garbage can full of batteries.
Mm-hmm. I just call your house and say battery recycling center and I'll be transferred to that?
Well, therein lies the real problem, which is the recycling center is only one. It's a total pain in the ass to get to. So I literally have 2 or 3 years worth of batteries piling up in this bin, and I don't even want to know what's growing at the bottom of that can.
Nice. Well, now you know what you need to do today.
Take my batteries in for recycling.
I can hear the public service announcement music now playing here on the Hansel Minute Show. Bum, 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 bum. The more you know.
The more you know.
Yeah.
So I got really bent up the other day looking at how far behind Windows Mobile had gotten with 6.5 and thinking about Win 7. And it suddenly hit me that I don't know if it's even relevant anymore.
Mobile operating systems at all?
Yeah, I don't think you need mobile, because I'm looking at the next two generations of PDA hardware coming out have got the horsepower of an average desktop.
So, at least, yeah. I mean, doesn't the average Windows Mobile device have like 600 megahertz, iPhone 600 megahertz?
Well, and now an ARM announced they're going to start making multi-core processors for PDAs.
Wow.
So, you know, we're just not that far away from having 4 gigs of RAM and 2 or 4 cores in our PDA. What do I need a mobile OS for? I can run Windows on that.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd love to have tiny Windows 7.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
And plus, a Cradle, just plug it into a regular screen and keyboard and off you go.
Yeah, yeah.
So suddenly you get this idea of, I'm no longer carrying a USB key around with my essential documents. I'm just carrying my machine.
Hmm. Okay, you think it's going to happen? You think that we're secretly working on some tiny Windows 7 thing?
I don't know that I think anybody's particularly planning it, but I think it's utterly inevitable.
Hmm.
I've got my portable server rig, right? The bag with the little servers in it. I mean, those are dual core. There's a new board out now. Same form factor. It's a 6-inch by 6-inch board that'll run quad core and 16 gigs of RAM.
Hmm.
So, tell me how this can't happen. I think we're struggling so much with these different variations of OSs and platforms and things. It's just easier to make the horsepower come to the machine, right? Like, remember that? Who is the guy who came up with the line that said, it was easier to put internet everywhere than it was to make a good disconnected client? And I think the same thing is happening, where it's easy, rather than trying to make a mobile OS that's efficient and all those sorts of things, we're just going to bring the horsepower everywhere.
I don't know, but again, the power.
Well, power consumption is always going to be a challenge, but that's still in the hands of the hardware guys. ARM is winning these days, you know, beating out everybody else's processors, because while they're giving us multi-cores and all these cool things, they're consuming power really efficiently.
Hey, everybody, this is Scott coming at you from another place in time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work. And you know, writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit, not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot. why doesn't the iPhone and devices like it automatically shut things on and off? The joke about the iPhone is that it's a great phone and it'll last for a long time as long as it's off.
Yeah.
You have to shut everything off. And they haven't even, in the latest version, come up with a nice single dashboard. There's like 22 clicks to get things shut off.
Yeah, I think that developers treat power consumption like they treat security. That's somebody else's problem. I'll do it later, whatever. Because when they're working on it, it's plugged in.
It's true. It's true. There's actually a lot of documentation on how to write a good Microsoft application that is a smart power consumer.
Yeah.
It can shut off pieces of itself. You can turn off background threads. You know, I think that the only app that really does that is Outlook, about that knows that you're on battery and thinks about what it can do.
Yeah.
To make the battery life last longer.
And be less aggressive. But heck, you know, this is the big claim to fame of the MacBook, right? Is you close the screen, you open the screen, you still have a computer. I defy you to find virtually any Windows laptop that works correctly on.
Well, I would actually push back and say that anyone not running Windows 7, because that's when I finally can close. I mean, seriously, that's a really great example of the amount of confidence one can have in an OS, is that if I can close it and not like do that, you know, is the light in the refrigerator off?
Yeah.
Thing, then that's a sense of confidence. I totally close my Lenovo happily running Windows 7 without any concern at all for, you know, what's going on. It will shut off. It will shut off correctly, and I will be able to turn it back on, and it will work just fine.
So my problem is I'm carrying a Motion Computing LE1700 Slate tablet, and there is
no lid.
You still
are carrying that thing around.
I am. The battery life on it's absolutely epic. I can't resist the thing. It's wonderful. But I did that. It was going into shutdown. I've still got Vista. Or no, I put Win 7 RC on it. Went into a shutdown cycle. It's a shutting down. So I stuffed it in my bag and I pulled it out on the airplane 2 hours later and it was still shutting down.
Yeah.
And the battery, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess I don't have quite as much battery. And it was just a bit tiny toasty being stuffed in the bag while it was still shutting down.
Yeah. You know, I've heard things about laptops waking up for midnight bits of work or backups or whatever, you know, midnight defrag, and then bursting into flame inside of a backpack.
I never had a machine burst into flame yet since like the Apple II Plus. I burned up a floppy drive by plugging the thing in wrong.
Yikes. That's not good at all.
Just a long time ago.
Okay. Hey, one of the things that you had wanted to talk about and you'd sent me a note about was the idea of some of the big shows, the big conferences and stuff are dying.
You know, the downturn impacted conferences across the board. Everybody took a hit, right?
Right.
And it's not easy. I don't envy anybody in the conference business. And goodness knows we go to lots of conferences. But you and I were together at NDC in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
What a scream of a conference. Just a great show.
That was
show.
Amazing. I mean, they held the conference inside a soccer stadium
because
it was too big to be anywhere else. And even now, they're still struggling to keep the torrents up so people can download the video of the talks. And this has been, what now, 4 months?
Yeah. Huge demand. So I just got back about a couple weeks back now. I spent the weekend in Nashville at a conference called DevLink. Guy who runs it is volunteer. His name's John Keller. Totally user group centric kind of show. 700 people there. And it had that buzz of a really happening, excited conference, people sitting in the hallways, chatting with each other. There was an open spaces section that was really busy. I did a couple of talks that were full. Carl was there with me. We did a .NET Rock style closing with a panel discussion and all that sort of thing.
Nice.
It felt like the big tier one shows of old.
Back when you could have 15,000 people and have that same feeling.
Yeah.
But and now you're saying it was a big show, 700 people.
700 people who paid $100 a piece to be there.
Why? What was the formula? Was it the $100? Was it the right 700 people? What made it awesome?
I think you have a local draw. So there was really a sense that everybody knew everybody. Like I was sort of the foreigner there. But people drove, it's the Midwest, right? So people drive a fair distance. They're willing to, there's lots of folks in from Ohio and from Michigan coming all the way down to Tennessee. I think that's part of it. It had a serious community feel. It was on a university campus. So there was a great hub of activity around coming and going from there. But I think that you're growing the right people that are really excited to be there and really their expectations are set well. I've been reading a book called The Paradox of Choice.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this book?
I have heard of the book. I think it's in my queue, my Amazon queue.
Absolutely. Wonder.
I'm reading Free right now, which is that book about freemiums.
Interesting. One of the things that Paradox Choice really gets into is this whole idea that your expectation significantly affects your actual experience. And the scenario they sort of paint is, suppose you're going to one of the best restaurants in town, and mm-hmm. your friends have told you it's the best meal they've ever had in your life, and you've had a really great day, and on and on and on. So it's almost, you feel sorry for the chef, because there's almost no way he could meet your expectations. Even if he knocks out of the park and does everything perfectly, it's only going to meet your expectations, never going to exceed. Where
that's true.
You walk into a restaurant after a terrible day with no idea what the place is like, and the guy just treats you nice and serves you something half decent, and you're happy. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the tier one shows got so big and so expensive and so extravagant, we could never meet our expectations anymore.
Well, plus there's the fog of war aspect of things, in the sense of, I remember that the conferences were like this.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were. You know, I remember 15,000 people descending on Orlando and everyone being awesome and the parties being amazing and Counting Crows was hired and they did the show party.
Yeah.
But did I remember it correctly?
Yeah, was it actually that big? Was it actually that good? You know, how long do we wait? Because you sort of edit out the how long do we wait for food? We couldn't get in.
Yeah, yeah. But I think your point is really interesting. People, this actually made me think of, I always get teased when I go overseas that even though I will try crazy food, I try to eat Subway or some chain before a talk.
Right.
Right. You know, I'm not going to go, if I'm in Sweden, I'm not going to go try Swedish food for the very first time 2 hours before I speak. It's just a bad idea. So people are like, oh my goodness, you went to Morocco and you found a Subway? What are you doing? You know, Subway sandwiches.
Yeah.
But it's my expectation, which is that Subway is Subway pretty much everywhere in the world. And I was in Toronto and I went to Subway and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And it was predictable opulence. You know what I mean? It was exactly what I needed at the time. And I had my expectations set appropriately and I had my Subway sandwich and it was comfort food. Had my expectation been set in any other, you know, up or down, or if I had no expectation at all, the psychic weight of the stress it would have put on me would have made my talk a lesser talk.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we're seeing with these lightweight, low-cost shows is when you're only in for $100, even if you get a decent lunch, you're probably pretty happy. And if you get a couple of good sessions, and granted, they can't pay the speakers. So this gets back to that whole, you remember your video with Ted about the death of the speaker?
The Death of the Professional Speaker. It's a video up on channel9.msdn.com that Ted Neward.
Right.
Lamented the death of the professional speaker.
But when people's expectations are such that I didn't have a huge commitment here, when I don't get a great talk, I'm like, that's fine. Where, and I think one of the concerns you see this, I certainly see this online, is folks are saying, hey, I spent $3,000 to go to this top tier show, flew all this way, expensive hotel room, da 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 da, and the talk still sucked.
Mm.
So I think one of the reasons that these little shows are doing so well is expectations are reasonable and they're getting sufficient results for their money.
Well, does that mean it's over for the big conferences? Well, I mean, is it all about, you know, CodeMash and these smaller regional conferences now?
Well, what worries me about the regional conferences is that I don't feel like they're sustainable because there's no profit motive there. Those guys aren't making any money off
the show. They're
doing
it for the love of it.
But love runs down, my friend. They also find out it's
love
really
hard
work.
Love runs down?
Yeah. You know,
that sounds like a country music song. What does that mean, love runs down?
Eventually, you're going to get – it's very hard work to put on a show like that. Like, if you go to one of these conferences, you got to pat those guys on the back. But after mm-hmm. a couple, 3-4 years of doing this, they're going to be tired and wondering, you know, why they're still doing it. And people do get critical of these shows. It's very hard to do. So to me, it feels like they're not sustainable, that eventually these things will unravel unless they migrate into a model that is less individually centric, right? I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. John Keller was at the center of DevLink. You got guys like Bill Wagner and Diane Marsh, and there's a bunch of folks that work on CodeMash. And every show's got that. Three key people. When those people move on, they're ready to do something else, can that show sustain itself? And that's my concern, is that we may see this wave coming of this style of show that then collapses under the weight of its dependence on volunteerism to function.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I think people can do when they say, what do I do to get involved in community? You know, there is often a personality or an individual or a group of individuals, a brain trust that keeps these things running, whether they be your local .NET users group or your local Nerd Dinner or your local, regional conference. And if you don't step up as a member of the community and help out, those things will just fade away.
Absolutely.
You know, Fred Fredrickson will decide, I'm tired. I've been doing this for 5 years. Let's hand it over to the community. And then it just falls away.
It comes apart. Well, and I wonder if we're not just in a cycle that the big shows got a little too expensive and too opulent. And if they lighten up a little and get a little less expensive and get a little less ostentatious, as this cycle comes around of these essentially volunteer shows spinning down again, those people go, hey, let's put on a big show. I'm willing to spend $1,000 to get involved in something like that. We'll see a resurgence of that. But, mm-hmm. you know, there's another route. And I've had this experience in Europe where folks turn a user group into almost a more formal organization. The dues go up. There's a paid employee that operates that group, and they do a conference every year. And again, it's still a not-for-profit. They spend all the money they bring in, but there are people paid to operate it so that it's sustainable long-term and not dependent on an individual or a few individual volunteers to keep it running. And it becomes a much more formal not-for-profit organization.
Hmm. I wonder if Microsoft start doing Mix West and Mixed East and Tech Ed Southwest?
It's an interesting question. Is that the real question you've got to ask is, should Microsoft be in the conference business at all?
No, that's a very good question. But right. if they're not, then they have to count on the local conferences, the regional conferences
right.
to exist.
Well, and you look at a conference like DevLink, and DevLink had some sponsorship, and I don't necessarily know who all of them were, but there were vendors out there who want to reach that audience that were willing to contribute some money to make the conference function. Why shouldn't Microsoft just be another vendor in this scenario?
That's a good question.
You know, yeah, support the small shows, and you could support them in so many ways because you do have a community connection and you can provide some financial support as well as organizational support.
I'll take that feedback to the people.
Very nice. Richard Thank
Campbell.
You.
Richard Campbell says, no, I think you've got a good point. I think that smaller community run sustainable conferences might energize people more than the, I think that there should be probably one big, conference.
And again, you get back to what is the motivation here?
Yeah.
I remember hearing TechEd described to me as the opportunity for Microsoft employees to get close to their customers. And to me, that's a good idea for Microsoft and it's a good idea for the customers. I don't know that it actually works that way.
No, it doesn't work that way at all.
But that to me seems like a good idea. And I also don't have a problem.
You think so? But hang on, though. You're saying that someone described to you that the TechEd was Microsoft's opportunity to get close to the customers. We should be getting close to our customers, all the time. And certainly not just the ones that can afford to fly somewhere and pay $2,000 to do it.
I don't disagree with you there that, yes, okay. You always need to be in contact with your customers. But this sort of marquee event that is the big opportunity, that every, all these folks inside of Microsoft that normally don't get outside get to get out there. And you have these presentations, to me, when I go to a TechEd, and admittedly, I present at TechEd, you present at TechEd, so we've got our own biases anyway. But when mm-hmm. I go to a session, of a guy who is inside of Microsoft who built that technology and is going to tell you why it works the way it works. You won't get that information anywhere else. And that, to me, is valuable, right? Without a doubt. But
no, I agree.
What I worry about when Microsoft puts on conferences is that it's suppressive of the community-based conference, that it overrides that conference because they do have more money to spend and they are larger and they, quote, are Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
especially when those things tend not to be sustainable. Often Microsoft gets into these ideas, the local sub gets this idea of doing this particular tour, doing these particular kinds of events, and that only goes on as long as that guy is there. Eventually, he gets his promotion or moves on to a different job and so forth, and it falls apart. But in the 2-3 mm-hmm. years that he did his thing, the domestic stuff, the local stuff can't survive. It gets stepped on, and so suddenly we're left with nothing. And that
right.
very frustrating to me that we get into those circumstances.
Right. And everybody loses.
In the end, yeah, what we really want is that sort of consistent opportunity. I like the idea that I can get together with my peers on a routine basis in a venue where we have a deep insight into the different lines of products that we care about, and I can talk to my peers about what's going on and where we're going with it.
I think you're onto something.
I'm trying to be, but, you know.
How can we call it, we can make it happen, we can call it CampbellCon.
Oh, God. Yeah, you know, I have a lot of respect for people who organize conferences. I've worked with them enough to know it's really hard. I've done tons of content planning over the years. I mean, in the end, .NET Rocks is really a content planning exercise more than anything else.
Totally.
And, but I would never want to be that guy, to be honest.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, just didn't Gnome Dex, right? That's Chris Perillo's thing.
Yeah.
Just happened last weekend. And, you know, and every once in a while when I'm kind of, you know, sitting on my couch, rubbing my fat belly, watching TV, I think to myself, why don't I have a conference?
Why don't you?
Let's make HanselCon.
HanselCon.
And then I realize that Chris Perillo has boundless energy and organizational skills, neither of which I possess. So oh, look, TV's on. Yeah. So, yeah, so the conference never actually happens.
Yeah. Dancing with the Stars came on and the whole thing went away.
So you got to give people respect if they have that that kind of energy to pull something together.
Absolutely. He's a very special talent, and it's fun to be a contributor to stuff like that. But yeah, never had an urge to own it myself.
Right. To own it involves a special kind of insanity.
Yeah. Well, and a level of maturity and reliability that I have a tough time with.
I'm glad that you agree.
I'm self-actualized.
You have no business having a conference.
I'm totally with you. I've certainly learned to embrace my character defects for the forces of good.
Excellent. Excellent. Oh, it's so fun to talk to you, Richard.
Where do you want to go next, my friend?
Where do I want to go next? I'm just learning how to be a boss right now.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about this, because that was a heck of an announcement. And then, and now you're trying to fill these roles. I mean, congratulations for first and foremost.
I don't know if it's that big of a deal. The difference is that, before when I led teams, it was more, being in charge of people implicitly.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I'm running a team of 3 to 10 or whatever, but I wasn't doing their HR stuff.
Right.
So there's the, administrivia of being a boss. Then there's the leadership part. Leadership is an ongoing learning process, and that's just something that you do. The part I'm having trouble with is the administrivia. It's the HR stuff and the expense reports and all that kind of crap. Someone should outsource that. There's got to be a way to have somebody else do that.
Just a better way to go about that stuff.
But see, you don't get that until you're a really, really bossy boss, right? When you're like a VP of something.
Right.
Then suddenly, you know, other than, the yearly reviews, you don't have to, you know, you have to provide leadership and do one-on-ones, but I don't want to fill out forms for expenses and stuff like that. You know, if guy spent $5 on a Subway sandwich, you know, more power to you.
Yeah, but isn't it your job just to simply sign off that, yeah, that's a legitimate business expense?
No, yeah, but even that is boring to me. I mean, it's just like, you know, add those things up, right? You get 4 or 5 guys working for you, and then when I hire these other guys, I'll have like 7, and it's going to mean half an hour a week where I got to go through the, you know, click, 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 approve. I find that tedious. Not value-added time, right? Because remember, I'm a guy that really tries to keep track of what I'm doing, and is it valuable, and is it time well spent?
Interesting problem. Isn't the hiring part of this one of the hardest, most difficult?
Well, so that's funny that you mentioned that. I think I've blogged like 9 or 10 times this week, and this month, and it's really stressing me out because I'm not doing what I want to be doing because I'm so busy trying to hire somebody.
Right.
I mean, I've got hundreds of resumes to sift through, and I've got some people who are supporting me in HR, but they gave me a thing to fill out that says, you know, give me the list of keywords so that I can screen these resumes for you.
Ouch.
It's like, yeah, right. And that's, you know, the kinds of community jobs that I am hiring for, this is not the way we're going to do this. The person for this job is not going to be found by looking for keywords.
Yeah. No, these are, this is a community thing. It's a very personal kind of task.
Yeah. So I got to go through it myself. So I've been spending all this time doing this and not the time I want to be spending working on what I want to be working on, which is ironically exactly what Chris Sells said was going to happen when he said, yes, you know, it's over for you and all productivity in the public.
Yeah, actually doing anywhere. Well, I remember that was back earlier in the month there, that Hansel Minutes on 9. Mm-hmm. He just said, yeah, your job now is to make everybody else productive. Don't worry, you're not going to have any productivity yourself.
Yeah, I'm still in denial. I refuse to admit that. No, that's nonsense. I have no interest in being a manager. I would like to be an enabler. I want to be an empowerer. Is that a word?
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that I'm interested in doing. So the idea of taking the role is so empower these other guys. That doesn't mean I want to stop doing, the stuff that I think I'm pretty decent at doing. So the trick is to find a balance. Fortunately, these are senior guys. It's not like I'm babysitting here. You know,
yeah, no, I look at your lineup.
Whole team full
there.
Of senior guys. So that's not a huge deal. It's just the administrivia. It's just the, now I have a regular weekly one-on-one with different people and I've got to fill out some forms, and that's tedious. Plus, when you're a team, they want to know, there's all sorts of monthly status reporting to other bosses higher up. And again, it all adds up to a couple of hours of administrivia. The problem with that is that it can add up to a day if you're not paying attention.
Right.
And I can't accept a day of admin work.
Well, yes, I used to measure my productivity in interruptions per hour, recognizing that the higher that number was, the less productive I was.
Interruptions per hour?
Yeah.
That's good.
I found that software development worked best at an interruption per hour rate of 0.25 or lower.
So that means an interruption every 4 hours.
No more. Any more than that, my productivity as a developer substantially goes down. And I got so frustrated with dealing with this in an office that I used to hang my interruption per hour number on the wall outside my office. And each time you phoned me, it added to another interruption. It started with, I had a boss who would ask me to do a task. I'd say, that's going to take me 2 hours, and then phone me every 15 minutes on it.
Uh-huh.
So I started adding 15 minutes to the time each time he called. Says, yeah, I'll have that done by 2 o'clock. And then he'd call back at 11:30 and say, how's that coming? He says, I'll have it done at 2:30. You said 2 o'clock. You phoned again.
Yeah.
And if you phone again, it'll be 3. Because interruptions are, and my point really being that as a manager, you suddenly, interruptions become a key part of your day. Mm-hmm. That you sort of have to commit to interruption heavy days, and in exchange for, with any luck, getting a low interruption day.
See, that's nice. Is it about controlling the people who could potentially interrupt you? Or is it about just hiding?
I think there's a hiding element to it. I think there's an effort to go into your office and eliminate interruptions, like turning off email and setting D&D on the phone, like those kinds of things, so that it's not easy to interrupt you. Right? My whole point about hanging that sign of my interruption rate was to make people stop and think, do I want to interrupt him?
Mm. See, that's interesting. Last time, when was I talking about this? I think it was a show recently. I was talking about getting a big on-air sign. Like an old-style radio on-air sign.
Yes.
And a bunch of people said you can get them on eBay. I was thinking about building one. I don't want to spend too much money. But the boys, as they interrupted earlier on the show here, tend to kind of launch themselves at the door. You know, nothing is scarier if you have any kind of zombie issues about, you know, two toddlers throwing their shoulder into the door. You know, except they're not looking for brains. They're like, Daddy.
Thump,
thump, thump, thump, daddy. So I'm thinking that a blinking light that says on air will clearly get the children off me.
Not go away? Because that's really what it says anyway, isn't it?
Do I really want a blinking sign that says go away flashing over my door? Maybe I do, actually.
I was just thinking, in the whole zombie scenario thing, the good news is you could aim a shotgun at about mid-door, so if it is a zombie, you'll get him in the head. But if it's a toddler, it's going to go below him anyway. But the explosion is going to be enough to probably make him think, should I really hit that door again?
Wow. I think that we should stop the talk now because that was perfect. That was the perfect ending. Bothered at work? Got a home office. Try a shotgun just higher than a toddler's head.
There you go.
Wire that up to your phone system. You know, you'll very likely be prototyping this later today.
Yes, just push the blue button and say, reduce my interruptions per hour. Shotguns deploy automatically.
Right over the head of the children.
There you go.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you so much for hanging out.
Always a pleasure, sir. We'll do it again sometime.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.